Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. I'm great.
So this week has witnessed the beginning of a new phase in the impeachment inquiry with, we now have open hearings that people can watch on television or online or wherever people watch things nowadays. But we've also noticed a slight shift in the rhetoric in the impeachment inquiry, where the Democrats are increasingly talking about the Ukrainian scandal as a form of bribery, and using that as a framework for talking about the Trump administration's impeachment-level offenses, if you will. So we thought we'd talk today about the history of bribery in the United States and how this current moment fits into that history.
Yeah, I mean, let's take a moment, though, to consider what this rhetorical shift might mean.
Yes.
For the past 2 months or so, or 6 weeks since this scandal broke, there's been much talk about a quid pro quo. Mm. And indeed, President Trump has consistently said there was no quid pro quo. I'm quite sure he doesn't know what the Latin quid pro quo means. Of course, it just means this for that.
That, yes.
So at one point in some of the testimony, some congressmen were actually using this language of this for that in order to make it understandable to the public. I think the shift of, and Nancy Pelosi most crucially used the word bribery to discuss what President Trump was trying to do vis-a-vis Ukraine. And I think she did that quite deliberately. And I think it's for two reasons. First is bribery is something that's more easily comprehensible to people in order to make this scandal comprehensible. And I think that that's important. I think the scandal, unlike the Russia scandal, is reasonably simple, but it simplifies it still further. People know bribery is wrong. But secondly, bribery is mentioned in the Constitution as well. In fact, it's mentioned in the impeachment clause.
Explicitly. So Article 2, Section 4, the President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. We had a previous episode where we talked about high crimes and misdemeanors when we were talking about the Russia investigation. And, you know, most people, when they think about impeachment, they immediately jump to high crimes and misdemeanors because that's the framework that has been used in the three previous impeachment either episodes in American history, whether that's with President Johnson, with Richard Nixon, or with Bill Clinton. It was always in the context of high crimes or misdemeanors and defining exactly what that language meant in those particular contexts. And one of the things that has came up especially in the Clinton impeachment was trying to figure out, okay, is the things that Clinton was accused of doing, did those fall under that particular rubric or not? And some of the debates people have with the Russian inquiry similarly had to fit, does that fall under high crimes and misdemeanors? Bribery, I think, if you're right to point out, is much more straightforward. People know what bribery looks like. And they know what extortion looks like, and extortion, I guess, is a form of bribery.
Yeah, but well, actually, before we historicize this, David, I find this a little bit curious because the Ukraine scandal, the narrative is relatively straightforward that President Trump threatened to withhold aid to Ukraine, indeed did withhold aid from Ukraine, unless and until President Zelensky of Ukraine launched an inquiry into Joe Biden, or more properly, Joe Biden's son and his involvement with a Ukrainian oil company alleging corruption, and crucially announced it publicly. So he wanted President Zelensky to announce this publicly, and so the bribe, if you will, this is more extortion than bribery in the sense that President Trump was withholding aid in exchange for extracting certain actions from President Zelensky. So I guess what he was looking for were goods and services rather than financial recompense.
Yes.
Because we think of bribery as, okay, I give you money illicitly to do something for me.
Yes. If you had money and I was willing to do such a thing, yes.
Right, and you had some, but so this isn't as straightforward. It's meant to simplify it, but it's not quite as straightforward as that, because the implication then is that the foreign aid is the bribe.
Yes. Well, it's about, so I think it's more clearly a kind of extortion, but I think extortion is a kind of bribe. It's a more complicated kind of bribe than the, I will give, you know, an exchange of money for a particular prohibited activity.
I mean, I know we have to get to what we want to do today, but I think there's a slight trap here. It could be for the Democrats, because one of the claims of Trump's defenders in this is that all foreign aid is a bribe, in the sense that wealthy countries give financial aid to other countries in order to get them to do what they want and to buy influence, and therefore, what's the difference? This is how they're spinning it.
Yeah, to be sure. I mean, and they are right in as much as all diplomacy is in some ways transactional. You know, states act with their own best interest in their relationship with other states, and they ask other states to do things in exchange for things. The thing that distinguishes this from that run-of-the-mill transactive diplomacy is that the transaction is not being done for the benefit of the United States, but for the benefit of a individual person and his political fortunes. Right, so it's not like we give foreign aid in exchange. The interest of the United States is that Israel or Egypt or whoever else the United States gives money to does a particular thing or doesn't do a particular thing, because that's in the U.S. foreign interest. This is about, the rebuttal to the Republicans' claim is this is specifically for Trump's personal political best interest. The Democrats' claim, but the rebuttal to the Republicans' claim that it's normal. This is actually quite different from those kinds of normal.
Because he will benefit personally, his campaign would benefit.
Right. There's no benefit to the United States generally for going after Hunter Biden.
Although Trump supporters and Republicans say there is a benefit to the United States because it would lead to the re-election of Donald Trump, which is beneficial to the United States.
Yeah, if we're going down that road, then all bets are off, because that's a justification for anything. That's justification for...
I can shoot somebody on Fifth
Avenue. Exactly. You can kill all my political opponents, because that would be good for me. And that's just their inherent. Yes. All right. So let's talk about the history of bribery, if this is what this is. What do the people in the revolutionary generation think about bribery? Clearly, they put it in the Constitution.
So well, that's right. So the fact that it's in the Constitution as one of the things that is explicitly prohibited suggests it's a problem. Now, the one thing I would say is the political culture of the revolutionary era and the early republic places a great deal of emphasis on personal virtue and also collective virtue. Governors or political officials are meant to be virtuous and not to profit from their offices necessarily.
This whole republicanism idea that Gordon Wood talks about.
Right. So famously, George Washington served as commander of the Continental Army for no pay, although he did get his expenses covered. So this is about selfless virtue. But the fact, as I said, the fact that those are values that are celebrated and also bribery is prohibited suggests that perhaps people aren't quite as virtuous as they're supposed to be.
Sure.
And that there is a degree of bribery that went on during the colonial period. I mean, there's a whole lot of not necessarily scandals, but there's lots of speculation going on in property and buying Western lands and there's smuggling that goes on. Customs officers can be bribed so that you don't have to pay taxes on your imports and things like that. So I'd say that there's a kind of low level of bribery in colonial America or colonial government, but it does go on.
I see. I would frame it in a different way. I would think there's a way in which you can read bribery as being embedded within the entire system. That these imperial officials appointed in London to be tax collectors or being governors of wherever, their salaries are not very big, but these are very desirable positions. Why? Because you can go into these positions and use the positions to make yourself a decent amount of money. They're not going to be governor of New York because they really want to be the governor of New York.
I guess we have to make a distinction. I think bribery is a subset of corruption.
Okay.
So not all corruption is bribery, although all bribery is corruption.
It's a form
of corruption. So I think there are emoluments. There's an emolument clause. So there are ways that officials do enrich themselves. There's no doubt about that. Acquiring Western lands being one.
Sure.
I was thinking directly of, again, a cash transfer of, illicit cash transfer for services.
Yeah. I think that a lot of that is happening.
Well, I think, right, I think it is happening, which is why it's prohibited.
Yeah. I think, so I think one of the things they're trying to do with the revolution is to try to create a new way and structure of thinking about governance that isn't, connected to this republicanism. That is different from, in meaningful ways, from both the colonial experience of corrupt, imperial officials and sort of the European practice.
Yes, I'm sorry, I agree with your general principle that they are trying to do something different, and we're going to get to diplomacy in a minute, and I think it is relevant. But there's not a lot of government in colonial America. There's just not a lot of governance. Well, there aren't a lot of officials to bribe, and most of the government that goes on is at the local level. So you're right. I think there is a crucial difference, because the kind of corruption you're talking about is at the imperial, at the metropole, at the center. And once the United States becomes a political center itself, because it has a national government, this will become an issue. So I think they're trying to avoid that. And are there corrupt officials in colonial America, imperial officials? Sure. But I don't think... Again, I think I'm taking a more localized and also more literal interpretation of our topic today, of bribery, than you are. And I think we're in slight cross purposes.
Okay, so let's talk about then when after the Constitution gets all set up, and when does the early Republic confront questions about bribery?
Well, the most famous early incident is the so-called XYZ affair in 1797 and 98. And the XYZ affair, I think this is the second time in a couple of weeks or 3 weeks or episodes where we're talking about the quasi-war with France.
France, yes. Well, I wonder why.
So the XYZ affair, the quasi-war with France breaks out with the election of John Adams in 1796. We do not need to rehearse this.
Listeners are well versed now in the quasi-war with France.
Except insofar as the United States sends diplomats to France, including John Marshall, and these three American diplomats go, and they're charged with trying to negotiate an end to improve Franco-American relations. Mm. And they meet several French officials who are codenamed X, Y, and Z in the dispatches the Americans send home, who say, well, if you want to see the government, if you want to meet Minister Talleyrand, who's the French foreign minister, you need to pay us a bribe, and pay him a bribe, more properly. So they're asking for a couple of things. They want a low-interest loan from the United States to the French Republic. Mm. They want the United States to assume responsibility for debts owed to French merchants, and they want, rather than the French government, and they want a direct payment. And it's the direct payment that really upsets people. And the American diplomats kind of clutch their pearls and say, we don't conduct diplomacy like this, and go off in a huff, and the quasi-war continues. And this becomes a kind of real pretext to ramp things up. And it's believed, after the collapse of these negotiations, that the United States will declare war on France. It doesn't do so for reasons we don't have to worry about, but there's a kind of war scare in 1798 as a direct result of the failure of these negotiations. What's interesting about this, I think, and perhaps germane to the Ukraine affair, to the business with Ukraine, is that it relates to foreign policy, and diplomacy. And you were suggesting that the new United States wanted to do things differently, and I think that's especially true in diplomacy. There was a long tradition of gift giving in diplomacy, especially in Europe, but not exclusively in Europe, of course, during the 18th century and beyond. We were talking off air, and you reminded me, I had forgotten, that Benjamin Franklin had famously been given a jewel encrusted snuff box by Louis XVI when he left France in 1785, and this kind of caused a bit of a stir. And there's a fine line between gift giving and bribery.
And where is that? How would people see that line in the revolutionary? I mean, it's the XYZ affair. Americans read that as a bribe,
right?
And the French read that as a,
this is the way diplomacy is done.
Yes. Okay.
So sorry. Where?
Well, I'm just curious. So I mean, I guess the interesting point is the Americans draw, that you said it's a fine line. I think the places where people are drawing that.
Well,
line.
Well, so yeah, and they draw that line in their diplomacy, but of course, gift giving is a big part of diplomacy with indigenous peoples, with Native Americans. The United States does that during this period. I think there is a distinction to be drawn between, it goes back to what we were talking about foreign aid a minute ago. There's a distinction to be drawn between trading or giving gifts almost at a national level to a group of people as opposed to giving money to an individual. Right. So the low interest loan France was looking for from the United States was less problematic than the fact that Talleyrand, you know, wanted, I think, $25,000 or something, or the livre. And so that's the issue. It's personally profiting from your office and extracting a bribe from somebody that the diplomats found objectionable. And that I think that the culture of the early republic found, at least officially found objectionable.
Yeah.
So I think that's the crucial difference. And I think this is germane to the situation with Ukraine. In certain ways, I think there are interesting parallels because, although you have to rethink this. So in this case, the great power is France. The weak power, the new fledgling republic that needs support and is subject to the whims of the great power, is the United States.
Okay.
And so in this analogy, France is the United States and the United States is Ukraine as the weaker country being pushed around. But in this case, the diplomats said no and blew the whistle.
Yes.
on the scandal rather than what we seem to have seen in Ukraine, where I don't want to torture this analogy quite much longer, except to say that if the Ukraine scandal maps onto the XYZ affair, it would be X, Y, or Z who blew the whistle on the bribery, on the extortion attempt.
Okay, I think I mostly followed that.
Right, it's not important. What's interesting is what we're seeing is bribery in foreign affairs and international relations, and this causes a major scandal. But then in the 19th century, we see the emergence, the practice of widespread bribery of the kind that we talked about at the beginning, which is, okay, I'm giving you a bag of money or an envelope of money because I want, I want the railroad to go through my town or that kind of thing. Do you want to talk a little bit about your incredibly corrupt period, David?
Okay, so the 19th century, by comparison to at least the more recent history, there is a lot of what we would consider political corruption and bribery. 19th century people didn't always read it that way, though.
Right.
There's a famous New York politician from the end of the 19th century named George Washington Plunkett, who took bribes left and right.
Graft is good.
And he talked about honest graft versus dishonest graft. And so he's making these distinctions between basically different kinds of ways of using political office to make tons of money. And he thought that the way he was doing it and the way that other people in Tammany Hall was doing it was entirely legitimate. And so, when we look at both the level of kinds of bribery and corruption more broadly that's going on, there's a lot. I think the interesting point is to look at when did they see it as going over that line that you mentioned. Where does profiting from one's office reach the point where their action needs to be taken on, where there's actually a threat to the republic.
Okay, sorry, before you, I mean, I think that's a good point, but I think what's interesting is the transition between the George Washington not taking pay for commanding the Continental Army because you have to be selfless and virtuous, to George Washington Plunkett and accepting that honest graft is actually the way the system works, and that's a good thing. And so there's a transition in the political culture that goes on, and you can only argue about where the line is between honest graft and dishonest graft, I suppose, if you're accepting graft.
Yeah, well, I mean, Plunkett was a professional politician, so I mean, we saw that as his job. George Washington was probably the top five richest people in the country when he was president, so not taking pay wasn't a great hardship for him, right? And so I think there's a way in which the democratization of politics and leads to different kinds of choices. And so you can look back at bribery cases, and there's tons of bribery cases at the local level of mayors and governors being involved in bribery scandals. On the federal level, there's really kind of a few moments in which you tend to see lots of accusations of bribery and convictions for bribery. One is during the Grant administration, which has a number of scandals that are bribery related. Secretary of War gets involved in a bribery scandal where the military is spending money and he's getting kickbacks for various things and bribes for directing government contracts in certain places. Probably one of the biggest bribery scandals is the Whiskey Ring, which one of the ways in which the federal government was funding itself was through whiskey taxes, just like they did after the revolution in some ways. And whiskey distillers and whiskey wholesalers and retailers were providing bribes to government officials to basically stamp say the taxes had been paid when in fact they hadn't. And so there are a whole number of people in the Grant administration who are implicated on this, including Orville Babcock, who was one of Grant's longtime aides and associates. The Secretary of Interior gets implicated on a land grant. So, you know, the Secretary of Interior is in charge of federal lands, and he's was accused of and convicted of selling federal land at below prices in exchange for a bribe.
And historically, I mean, I think a lot of these involve they involve people with access to resources.
Right. So there's a couple areas in the federal government that you see in the Grant administration that you see sort of recurring in other places and times. One has to do with people who control land. And there's some other famous examples of that in the 20th century.
Yep.
So secretaries of the interior and comparable positions that control federal land have the ability to, you know, exchange, to enact policy on their own in some ways. You find it a lot in military spending, right? So I think the military tends to have money to play with, and the people in charge of spending the money have some flexibility about how they distribute that money.
And that goes back to the revolution.
And there are all kinds of worries about corruption there. And of course, you know, the Grant administration is happening right in the aftermath of the Civil War. And so there are, you know, there's funding for various kinds of veterans programs and for fighting Indian wars, and all of which gave the military resources that then the people in charge of disseminating those resources could be persuaded through the pocketbook to spend in certain ways. And, you know, the Whiskey Ring is fundamentally about taxation. And there's ways in which people who are being taxed find it cheaper to bribe the people who are in charge of enforcing the tax than paying the tax. And so there are places, it's about administrative functions, tends to be where most of the federal corruption and bribery is taking place. But you also have, and this is a tricky one, some places during Grant's presidency where corruption, bribery is happening not only in the executive branch, but in the legislative branch. And that's probably most well-known, the Credit Mobilier scandal, which has to do with the building of the Transcontinental Railroad and the financing of the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. And the Union Pacific had set up basically a shell company to help actually do the construction and then build the federal government more than what it actually cost to do that, and then took that money to bribe congressmen to make sure that all these transactions took place.
So that's a very complicated one because it involves overbilling.
Yes.
And then taking the proceeds money from the overbilling to bribe congressmen.
Yeah. And not only bribe them in cash, but to bribe them in stock. And so there's ways in which, you know, one of the things that democracies and legislative bodies are supposed to do is try to prevent and limit certain kinds of corruption and bribery. After all, you know, if you have a monarchy, bribing the monarch or bribing a governor or bribing an individual, that's hard. But bribing an entire legislator is orders of magnitude more difficult, especially if you don't want to get caught doing it. And this is one of these examples where there are a number of congressmen who are involved to various degrees and being involved in accepting bribes in exchange for their votes. I think it is interesting that this is happening, you know, right in the aftermath of the Civil War, in which the size of the federal government is expanding tremendously, both in its taxing power and in its spending power. But at the same time, it has not had a commensurate growth in its sort of administrative structures of the federal government. So they are
law enforcement structures,
right? And so there's places where individual people have a lot more power to disseminate and use the sort of power of the federal government to collect taxes or to to spend money and the ability to influence people at very specific points in time by bribing them is that much more powerful. I think you have a similar thing happening in the 1920s during the Hardy administration, which is also known for having a number of scandals. And again, this is at a point in the aftermath of the First World War in which, you know, the federal government has taken on a whole load of new roles. It's at the end of the Progressive Era in which the power of the federal government is expanded. And, you know, the scandals are in predictable places. It's in the Bureau of Veterans Affairs. You know, and I think you saw some more thing in the Grant administration with the Army, where the Bureau of Veterans Affairs, the end of the First World War, is huge. It's a large portion of the federal budget, and they're spending all kinds of money on hospitals and pensions and all kinds of things that allow for bribes and corrupt spending. And in the biggest, probably the biggest scandal of the Hardy administration, what was often seen as the biggest scandal in American political history until Watergate, the Teapot Dome scandal, which involved federal land, which was a designated oil reserve in Wyoming. The Teapot Dome was the name of the geologic structure in which the oil was located. And the Secretary of the Interior, who your favorite guy?
Albert Bacon Fall.
Yes, who has, I don't know why anyone would have the middle name Bacon, but that's fine. Yeah. It's probably family. Anyway, Fall.
Like, this sounds like a perfect name for somebody involved in a scandal. Well, Albert, yes, Bacon Fall.
Yes. So Fall was bribed by several oil magnates. Most well known was Henry Sinclair of the Sinclair Oil Company to basically accept contracts to take the oil out of the Federal Reserve without taking competitive bids at below market rates and what have you. And so Fall ends up going to jail, and a number of other people get involved in that scandal. And so I think there are sort of moments in American history where there's the potential for people, the system being exploited through bribes. And I think the post-war periods tend to be those moments in their most pronounced way.
I mean, that's right. I mean, I know that, but it seems to me that the periods of greatest political bribery in American history are the 1870s and 80s, and sort of, as you say, post-Civil War, the 1920s. And then we have another surge in the 1970s and 80s of more conventional, you know, backhanders to politicians. And so we have a number of incidents then in the aftermath of, I mean, maybe Watergate is should be seen as a part of that kind of scandalous period. Yeah. Well, you don't get much in the aftermath of the Second World War, interestingly, and the growth of the security state.
But one thing you do get in the aftermath of the Second World War is you do get, you know, the second Red Scare leads to a kind of interrogation of government activities, not because people fear bribery, but because people fear communism.
Right.
And so I think that sort of hypervigilance, I think that kind of hypervigilance either meant that the bribery wasn't happening, or if it was, people were paying so much more attention to the fear of communism that they ignored it.
Right.
You know, one of the things you mentioned, sort of the post-Watergate period, in which there are a number of bribery scandals. There's one called Koreagate in 1976, where the South Korean government bribed 10 congressmen. This was after...
to what end? What did they want?
So Nixon was threatening... This was before Watergate. Nixon was... They were caught in 76, but the scandal emerged. The bribery happened before that. Nixon was threatening to pull U.S. troops out of South Korea, and... the bribe was to try to get the congressman to try to pressure the president to keep troops in South Korea.
Well, it's an interesting echo today, because I don't know if you've seen the most recent news about this, that President Trump, I think, is saying that that South Korea needs to pay
like 500%
increase more, to have U.S. troops in the country, which seems to be, I don't actually think he wants the money for that. I think he's trying to provoke them into not paying so that he can pull the troops out.
That's a possibility, given
but anyway, there's a cycle of Korea game right now.
But there's the Abscam scandal in 1980, in which there are six congressmen who were convicted of bribery, and that actually involved an FBI sting, not by actual foreign agents bribing people, but by the accusation, or by the sort of the sting was about foreign agents bribing U.S. congressmen. There's an operation in 1986 by the FBI called Operation Ill Wind that catches a number of cabinet-level officials or slightly below cabinet-level officials in the...
The Abscam thing, of course, was the subject of the film American Hustle.
Yes.
Recently.
One of the things about this, though, that strikes me is either what's going on in the late 70s and early 80s is a sort of resurgence of corruption, or it demonstrates that agencies like the FBI in the aftermath of Watergate are being more concerned about actually catching corruption than they had been previously. You know, so when we think about, you know, the history of bribery, we only know about the bribes that got caught.
Right.
And so we know about the bribes, you know, and partially, you know, the bribes that caught tend to be very big ones, but presumably there are lots of bribes that have happened at the federal level that we don't know about, because if you do it right, nobody knows about it. So I think maybe what's happening in the 70s and 80s, you know, is the FBI and, you know, the other sort of intelligence structures of government are, in the aftermath of Watergate, trying to reestablish their legitimacy as people who hold government agents to account for engaging in things like bribery by being hyper-vigilant about catching them, even if they are, you know, cabinet-level officials or members of Congress.
Well, let me ask you something, David, because I think the Trump administration is a really interesting test case for corruption and allegations of corruption.
Yes.
That's putting it mildly. But I don't... I guess it might be ironic if the bribery that brings them down or brings President Trump down, and at the moment that seems unlikely, but who knows, will be the extorting political favors from Ukraine, because we have much more blatant examples like the Trump Hotel. So we there are plenty of examples of people seeking to curry political favor, either international figures or domestic figures, staying at the Trump Hotel in Washington and spending large amounts of money at that hotel, which is a way of paying money to the Trump organization that appears to be legal, but...
And not only is the Trump Hotel in D.C., but the Trump Hotel's in New York.
Yeah. I mean, that's
the
right.
And golf course is here.
But spending money at Trump properties.
Yes, that's clearly a bribe.
Yeah. Well, is it? And I'm not defending that actually, but you know, Saudi Arabia can say, well, we've chosen to stay at the Trump Hotel in Washington because it's close to
the White House. So one of the things that's in the transcript people have noted, but probably not focused on that much, is one of the things Zelensky mentions is that when he was in D.C., he stayed at the Hotel.
That's right.
You know, and it's when you're bribing somebody, unless you're stupid, you don't say, here is a bribe for things. Right. I mean,
yes, one of the Trump administration's defenses about the quid pro quo is they never said, here is a quid pro quo.
Exactly. You know, that's not the way bribes work if you're at all subtle and don't want to get caught. So I think, you know, hotels, I mean, I think are... I don't know why you don't see that as bribes.
No, I didn't say I didn't. I'm teasing it up.
Yeah.
My question for you, though, about that, because I think is this, it seems actually, and perhaps inadvertently, to be both an order of magnitude more serious than sort of South Korea paying some congressmen, you know, get envelopes full of money.
Yes.
Which is how we think of bribes. It's both more serious and more sophisticated than that. But is this, so I guess what I want to know is the Trump era corruption, if we're going to stipulate that is corruption and bribery, is this a break with the past or is it a return to the style of the 19th century?
One of the things that strikes me is thinking about the George Washington Plunkett's definition of graft, and the distinctions between it. One of the things that is extraordinarily clear to anyone who's been watching American politics over the past 40 years is how important campaign finance is and the roles in which donors to campaigns get all kinds of access that people who are not donors or who are donors but not in large quantities do not. And the failure of the United States to enact meaningful campaign finance legislation to that the courts will support, because the courts have also struck a bunch of things down and said that corporations can give lots of money, other kinds of things. That is in a form, a skeptic would say, is kind of legalized bribery that, you know...
Well, so is lobbying.
Well, to be sure, which is all connected with campaign finance, right? And so you have, you know, money being exchanged for policy, money being exchanged for political appointments, money, you know, and, you know, some of the people involved in the Ukraine scandal were only in their positions as, you know, American ambassador to the EU because they gave Sondland, I think, had given $1 million, I think it was not to the campaign, it was to the Trump inauguration.
That's right.
And...
Which nobody attended, so...
Well, hey, we all saw the pictures, there were millions of people, right? We should have known we were in trouble then. I guess we didn't know. But the... You know, we have systems that sort of say, you know, that kind of exchanging money for things is legitimate because that's just the way the system is structured right now. I think looking at it from, you know, 100 years removed, like we are looking at George Washington Plunkett from 120 years removed, I think we would, future observers may say, look, all this entire system is built upon bribery of one kind or another. Nothing's happening in Washington without the aid of bribery, much in the same way that nothing happened in late 18th century Europe without the aid of bribes to make the wheels of government move or wheels of diplomacy move.
I agree with that.
Have to indict the entire system if you go to that route, though.
Yes, and the system is in need of indictment. It seems to me that what we're seeing, and we've talked about this in the past, is that we're in the midst of a moment that is very similar in certain ways to the Gilded Age. It's different in others, and it seems to me there will be something after Trump, and after this moment. And I imagine that just as we saw in the 18, just as the Progressive Era followed the Gilded Age, just as greater government oversight and special prosecutors followed Watergate, I think whatever comes next, there will be a kind of movement to try and curb some of the excesses of not just this administration, but that have been building over the past generation.
To be sure. All right, I think that's what, if there is a pattern to these kinds of things, that seems to be the most likely scenario. Now, what form that's going to take and how long that's also going to take,
and who knows,
is above and beyond our
pay. Yeah, and whether we get there immediately after Trump or whether it's, you know, after the Pence administration, God help us. Who knows? If we've proved anything, it's that we're terrible prognosticators.
Yes. Right. On that note, let's talk about things that are happening. We're going to do last drops and talk about things that are happening in the future.
Yes, so...
we can predict it's going to happen.
Last drop is something that will definitely happen, barring a meteor hitting the Earth in the next week. So next Friday, David and I will do a live episode of the Whiskey Rebellion. We will record a live episode of the Whiskey Rebellion at the French Institute in West Parliament Square here as part of the previously Scottish History Festival. So it's called Previously. Scottish History Festival. So as part of this festival, David and I will be making an appearance at the Institut Français at West Parliament Square, 7:45 to 8:45.
In the evening.
Yes, we're not doing it in the morning. Come on out and see us if you're local.
Yes, or if you're not local, you know, make a trip.
If you're in town, yeah. We'll record a live episode then. The theme we've been asked to address is the history of French-American relations, so the XYZ affair was relevant there.
Yeah, if you want more on the quasi-war with France.
But we'll also take questions and go where the conversation leads us.
Exactly.
We really enjoy doing.
So we'll have a good time.
Yeah.
There's a whole host of stuff that they're doing part of this festival, so I'll put up the whole program so people can
see the other things.
So I've been enjoying... And long-time listeners will know I'm kind of a comic book nerd. And I say it with affection. I've been enjoying the new HBO series Watchmen, which is a takeoff on a very famous graphic novel from the 1980s. Many listeners may have seen the movie that Zack Snyder made about 10 years ago. It's a really interesting adaptation of that. What does that have to do with American history? Well, the series begins with a depiction of the 1921 Tulsa Massacre, which is this episode of American, in sort of the nadir of American race relations, in which a very prosperous black community is attacked violently by white supremacists in Oklahoma. One of the things I've noted in sort of listening to people's commentary on the new television program, most of whom was being done by people who are not historians, but by people who like television or comic books or some such thing, is that they had never heard of the Tulsa Massacre. And so this is actually educating people about this historical event, and people are sort of astonished they didn't know about this episode. So it's a really interesting show thus far. I'm very eager to see where they take it, but I'm also glad they're embedding some kind of historical education in it, even if...
What do you think about using incidents like that for entertainment purposes, though?
So the whole premise of Watchmen definitely is embedded within the American historical narrative. So you look back at the comic book, it's very much intertwined with Vietnam, and it's intertwined with, you know, the history of the United States in the 20th century. So in some ways, this is on brand for the franchise to do that. And they do it in a very respectful way. I mean, it's a bit gruesome when you watch it, but it's also, I think, an important part of what this show is doing.
Apologies, my phone is ringing, but I won't get it.
Yes. So it's something that they very easily could have done wrong, but I think they did it right. And it seems to be a recurring touchstone in the show, harking back to this episode from 1921.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not familiar with the Watchmen.
Oh, I think, universe. Listeners, I think we need to make sure Frank gets a graphic novel.
No, I'm done. I remember watching some of the X-Men films when they go back to the origin story for Magneto, and yes, it's set during the Holocaust. And on one hand, it's well done. On the other, I do think I'm troubled by using incidents like that. And so I would include the Tulsa Race Riot basically for the purposes of entertainment.
Hmm. One of the interesting things about, and this gets into comic book nerdery, but that's fine. One of the interesting things is that Watchmen is a DC property. But it's outside the main DC continuity. And DC tends to take place in a fictional reality that's similar to ours. You know, so you have Gotham and Metropolis,
right,
and whatnot.
Sure.
Whereas Marvel tends to happen in a sort of modified version of our reality. You know, so you have Spider-Man living in Queens and what have you. And you're having Captain America fight in the Second World War and all these kinds of things. And so Watchmen in some ways is more similar to a Marvel continuity in that regard, in terms of it taking place in our world, and in which historical incidents are sort of used and twisted in interesting ways, because all comic books are fundamentally allegories about contemporary issues, and I think what the issues that Watchmen is addressing right now are about questions about race and policing, which are about as relevant today as they ever have been, and using the Tulsa Massacre as a sort of starting point sort of demonstrates the ways in which there are some continuities between racial violence today and the role of the state in legitimizing racial violence and its antecedents 100 years ago. But anyway, so that being said, make your own judgments, watch the show. It's good fun if you like that kind of thing.
Although I do listen to a competing podcast. Well, it's not competing with us. It's just a better podcast.
Okay. There are no better podcasts.
And they briefly discussed this. Actually, a hockey podcast, but that's another story. And they briefly discussed this. But the critique that was offered, because it was a similar conversation to ours, where two of the people on this podcast were very knowledgeable about, is it The Watchmen or Watchmen?
It's Watchmen.
Okay, see, I didn't even know that. And the other person was in my role. And one of the things that, one of the comments that was made was, you really need to understand the Watchmen universe and the backstory. You have to have read this comic book and probably seen the movie in order to understand the TV series.
Yes, I think that is, that is a, well, I think you could probably start without having seen those things, but there are the number of Easter eggs and embedded stuff. It all makes a lot more sense if you know that source material.
Right. So that being said, I think I can safely give it a pass.
All right. On that note.
Cheers. Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.